Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Tulsa Symphony Orchestra concludes its classic seasons with a concert featuring the music of Rachmaninoff, Richard Strauss, and Astor Piazzolla. That latter piece will feature principal bassoonist Richard Ramey as the solo instrument in an unusual arrangement of the composer's Angel Suite. My guest today is the guest conductor for the evening, British conductor Matthew Halls. Halls came to prominence as a keyboard soloist and early music conductor. His solo recordings of Bach's Harpsichord Concerti and Purcell's Sonatas in 3 and 4 Parts have been critically acclaimed, as well as his recording of Handel's Parnasso in Festa. He served as artistic director of the Oregon Bach Festival for 5 seasons, and today he's an active guest conductor with all sorts of repertoire with America's top orchestras, including the Cleveland, Philadelphia, Chicago, Dallas orchestras, and many others. He'll be making his first appearance with the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra this Saturday evening at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center, and he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Matthew Halls, welcome to Tulsa, and welcome to Studio Tulsa.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
Tell us a little about this program. What was your assessment when they gave you the program for this particular concert?
When I heard about this program, I was extremely excited because it's two of my very favorite pieces. The Strauss Tone Poem is well known, and it's dazzling sort of tour de force display for the orchestra. There are no passengers in that piece. And the Symphonic Dances, I don't know whether it's heard as much as, say, the Piano Concertos, but to my mind, it's Rachmaninoff at his absolute best. And I think it's the last piece he ever wrote, so it's important to hear it. And it quotes in the final movement, a movement from his all-night vigil from the famous Vespers, the choral piece, which he considered to be his greatest work. And that's the composer who wrote, you know, the second and third piano concerto. So I think we need to take note. I mean, these are fantastic pieces of music, and they sit side by side very well. A lot of dance influence, and that's why the Piazzolla piece fits in very, very well as well. Piazzolla was probably one of the most famous tango composers, the sort of new tango concept, fusing it with jazz and classical music. And it's always really lovely to get stuck into his music. It sort of loosens us up as classical musicians and allows us to explore other facets.
Well, you mentioned the Rachmaninoff Symphonic Dances. I understand you are right. It was the last piece he ever wrote, and he did reference a number of pieces. I think there's themes from the Symphony No. 1 in there.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
Do you think this was like a summing up piece for him?
Maybe. There's a lot of sense of nostalgia, I think. A lot of his sort of more serene moments in the symphony seem to be looking back and reminiscing, and you hear hints. Maybe if it's not quoted in full, you hear a transition passage, which definitely evokes the same feeling that you have when you listen to, say, the First Symphony. But it's also, I mean, it shows the religious side of Rachmaninoff as well, which might seem strange because it's a dance suite. He quotes in the last movement as well this chant, the Dies Irae, the Day of Wrath. And you hear it incessantly, but it always fascinates me that he doesn't set it in a very sort of macabre, grotesque style or bombastic style. It seems very uplifting and very buoyant and bounces along in a way, and it's kind of weird to hear that solemn chant being animated in that way. So it feels, at least at the very, very end, to be a very optimistic work, but I think along the way you do hear these flashbacks, if you like, to nostalgic references to earlier points in his life.
That's pretty weird hearing that chant in that way, because yeah. Every other composer that has dealt with that material, it's always been a harbinger of death, and it's usually right. Imminent destruction. You know, it's yeah. It's not something a composer uses lightly at all.
No, but it happens to be a very common melodic fragment that Rachmaninoff uses quite a lot. I mean, I'm a great lover of his choral symphony, which isn't done very often. It's called The Bells or Kolokola. And again, you hear that. It's distinguished by the alternation of the semitone. And you hear that in The Bells frequently. And it's hard to know whether that's a direct quote or whether it's just a favorite melodic figure of Rachmaninoff. But we know from his own sort of writings on the symphonic dances that that's there and it's legit.
I want to say some of the piano concertos actually sort of evoke that at
exactly.
times.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Well, interesting. And, you know, the Symphonic Dances, I guess they were supposed to be a ballet, but that never happened during
right.
his lifetime.
Yeah.
So you approach the piece as a dance music?
Yes, we're not dancing it this weekend, sadly. I'd love to say that we've got a troupe of dancers, and I've never had the experience of doing that sort of collaborative presentation. It's interesting because, I mean, a lot of it is dance in the sort of sense of rhythmic motors going on. So you feel a lot of this upbeat sort of rhythmic ostinato. But I wonder what a ballet choreographer would do with some of the more beautifully lyric, episodic moments. He writes a lot in the score during those sort of sections that you should be using tempo rubato. And therefore, it's very improvisatory and narrative. It tells a story for a while. And that would be suggestive not of that sort of drilled choreographic form of ballet music, but more of a sort of dreamy improvisatory sequence. But mm-hmm. You've just planted an idea in my head, which is that I must do these pieces with dancers before my time is up.
Well, you've done just about every other type of, opera, early music, a lot of emphasis on early music early in your career. And now you're branching out and doing all the standard repertoire, but also a lot of contemporary repertoire as well.
That's also, I mean, it's interesting to hear people describe my career like that because, of course, the reality was a bit different. We tend in the music world to place musicians in convenient pigeonholes. I always am very humble to say that I only ended up in the early music world at the beginning completely by accident. I just happened to be a keyboard player that was in the right place at the right time, and somebody asked if I would come and play a few chords in a Baroque orchestra. And I got hooked and I fell in love with it, but always at the same time there was the other repertoire going on. But it's very interesting to look back at that period in your music career and see that the CDs represent you as a certain thing, when in reality you would be doing Peter Grimes and Verdi Luisa Miller at the same time. But I'm endlessly fascinated by the variety of music, and I tend to stick to music from periods and pockets of repertoire that I just adore and can't get enough of. And that can span from the 1600s right through to the present day. But then I tend to avoid schools and areas of repertoire that don't resonate so well with me. And so it's less when the music comes from, more from whom and when.
Yeah. Has that been frustrating at times, that people know you for your harpsichord concertos or the Bach harpsichord concertos and your early music performance as conductor and, playing in the authentic music style or early music style?
Never frustrating, no. Yeah. I mean, I was so lucky to be involved in that movement because it really, I suppose it infects the way that I approach all music from any period. I still don't really understand what authentic means. I think it's a very handy marketing term, but, I suppose what it means is that we try as hard as possible, or we try to the extent that it is possible, to uncover and unearth what the composer might have been thinking about how to perform his or her own piece of music. And I'm not sure why that needs to stop at the Baroque. It just happened to be born in that area. I think any conductor who is taking their profession very seriously needs to be absorbed in the styles that they're performing to that extent, so that they can come at it from a point of view of how can I be the most faithful to the composer's intentions. And that's as relevant for Rachmaninoff as it is for Bach. But no, I mean, it was just incredible to be involved in all that Baroque music early in my career. And I was lucky to be involved in the recordings of cantatas, which I'll probably never perform or hear again because there are so many of them, and we don't get to hear some of the lesser-known ones very often. So I just consider it to have been a great privilege to have been absorbed in that style. I'm just cautious that I don't spend too much of my calendar year, my season, doing Bach. I like it to be balanced.
Right.
And that's the key for me, I think.
Yeah. Well, getting back to your point about why don't we take that same care and precision with, say, music from the late 19th century or early 20th century. Just think of the other piece that you're playing, the Till Eulenspiegel. Mm. How much the orchestra has changed in 130 years, just right. In the sheer virtuosity of the players to how an orchestra sounds compared to, the early recordings we have of that. Now, a lot of that was technology, and a lot of it had to do with limitations of technology, having to get the music done within a certain amount of time. But there's a lot of changes.
A lot. And I mean, it just reminds me, you know, even at that stage in music history, the brass instruments were different. Some of the wind instruments were different, and serious orchestras were still playing on gut string, at least some gut strings. And they were using techniques and effects that we tend not to use quite so much. I mean, particularly as string players, they would have been using much more portamento, which is something that in modern orchestral practice we tend to avoid. It doesn't really suit our 21st century taste, apparently. And on the odd occasion with an Elgar symphony or some repertoire from that period, when I've tried to put some of those elements back in, I've had limited success because it's not part of a musician's vocabulary, expressive vocabulary these days. So it's quite hard in a limited amount of time to get it to sound convincing and to pull it off. But I think, you know, the thing about Till is we think of Strauss and the sort of great Austro-German romantics as quite heavy, cumbersome composers writing music of great density and weight. But it's always amazing to me when you go back to some of the early recordings, I mean, before Sell and Cleveland in the 50s and backwards, you find very zippy, very clear, crystalline recordings of these pieces. And it suggests that actually our idea today of this heavy romantic sound is more to do with our modern aesthetic, how we like big orchestras to sound today in the symphony arena, and maybe not what Richard Strauss was expecting to hear on a day-to-day basis.
And you also have to say there might have been some evolution in how Richard Strauss, you know, thought of music, because Till Eulenspiegel is very different than, say, the four last songs or things that he wrote in the 1920s or 30s or 40s.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Till is the great sort of character piece par excellence about a rogue, a prankster. And so it gives a composer an unlimited license to break every rule in the book. And Strauss does it superlatively. It's even from the first measure when the horn player comes in with the notoriously difficult horn solo. You realize that Strauss is pulling your leg already because the math doesn't work. He writes it in a meter, which is 6/8 notes in a bar or in a measure. And the horn solo is actually phrased in 7. So it doesn't add up. And immediately you're caught off guard. You think, whoa, hang on a minute. I don't understand this music. And you're not supposed to, because it's about a rogue. And it's about a rogue who's going to pull your leg at every corner. And I just love that, because it brings out everything that Strauss was as a composer, his sense of theater and drama. And he marries the grotesque with the sort of whimsical and the flirtatious, with the heavy, doleful tones of a lover who's just been shunned. It's all there. And then the scene where Till is strung up on the gallows is one of the most beautiful bits in the whole piece, because you hear absolutely everything, and some of it's quite gory. You hear the sort of death sentence being given in the trombones with the descending seventh. And then you hear literally a musical depiction of him being hoisted up, and then it drops, and of course the neck snaps. Horrible to talk about these things on radio, but this is this sort of primitive form of execution. It's all there in the score. And then there's this beautiful touch where the flute shakes just between two notes, very, very high. And that, of course, is the rigor mortis setting in. And then he's lowered down gently as the winds fall back down to earth. And the whole piece is just full of those sort of little musical poetic depictions. And as such, for a conductor and a player, it's just an absolute treasure trove of expressive devices.
You mentioned that he breaks a lot of rules. You mentioned the opening figure that's sort of not exactly in meter. What are some of the other rules he breaks?
Well, I mean, he writes this section in the middle, which is supposed to parody the academics, the learned elders in the community. And we're talking, of course, on a university campus, so you need to be careful here. But the way in which they're portrayed as essentially being quite pompous. And when Strauss writes this, he tries to suggest that they are firstly in disagreement, and secondly, that they can't quite make sense of what Till, the roguish Till, is asking of them. They can't work out his logic, and that is because, of course, his questions are entirely fatuous. There is no logic. So what he does is he takes a fairly standard and well-regulated musical form, the double canon, we learn canon as kids at school.
Right. So, Jacques.
Right, yeah. Exactly. And then he sets it in such a way that the distance between the entering voices gets tighter and tighter. And what you end up with is basically complete cacophony from a harmonic standpoint. But contrapuntally, he's basically adhered to the rules, but to the extent that he's sort of broken all the rules of harmony. And that's just the most beautiful scene in the piece. I think there's not one person in the hall who won't be listening to it, wondering whether actually we might have just gone slightly wrong for a few measures. I can assure you that we haven't. It's actually the way Strauss writes it. He writes music using, you know, such an attention to detail, but ultimately it sounds like complete chaos.
Well, let's give listeners a little bit of a preview of that. Let's hear that little section here of Till Eulenspiegel's Merry Pranks, which will be performed by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra in their final classics concert of the season with guest conductor Matthew Halls in a program featuring Strauss, Piazzolla, and Rachmaninoff symphonic dances. That's music that will be played by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra Saturday night at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center with my guest today, guest conductor Matthew Halls, who has led the Oregon Bach Festival. He's been guest conducting quite a bit. You had your Chicago Symphony debut, few months ago. Handel and Haydn Society of Boston. Been at St. Louis several times and really conducting a lot in North America now.
Yeah, well, very lucky to be conducting in North America. I mean, it's a long way from home. I'm originally from the UK, but my wife and I live with our son in Toronto now, so it's a bit closer. It's easier for me to hop across, and I suppose it works out 50-50. 50% of my year is spent this side of the Atlantic, and then the other is spent the other side. But since about 2009, I've been coming to America fairly regularly, and I always love working here. I love the work ethic of the orchestras and the level, the standard, and the way in which they put things together very, very skillfully and very quickly and very professionally.
Yeah. Is there a big difference in the rehearsal practice between, say, the UK and America? I know there's some differences between the continent and America, or is it about the same?
I used to think so, but now, actually, I think I was just misguided. I think it's more that every orchestra has its own identity, and you can think that one sort of identity is more prevalent one side of the Atlantic than the other, but actually it's just which orchestra you happen to be with. You know, every orchestra has its strengths and its weaknesses, and those characteristics are universal. But it's just important to remember, as a European conductor coming over to America, that the rehearsals are a little shorter. And that is a blessing and a curse.
Well, let's talk about the third piece on the concert. And that is a piece that people will know perhaps some of the movements of, but they've probably not heard them all together. And that is the Angel Series, or Serie d'Angel, by Astor Piazzolla. Tell us about this piece.
Well, this is the first time that I do this piece, and certainly I've been aware of it in other versions. Piazzolla came from Italian immigrants in Argentina and spent the greater part of his life writing dance music. Again, I mean, inspired by the tango traditions of Argentina. This short series of pieces is known in very, very many different guises, and the version that we're performing this week is a rather beautiful transcription for a small string ensemble. So we get rid of all the heavy brass and the double woodwinds, the triple winds for the Strauss and the Rachmaninoff, and we really pare it down to this small I hesitate to say jazz ensemble. I mean, it straddles worlds between tango, jazz, and classical. And that's why I think we're drawn always as classical musicians, because it becomes accessible to us. If you have ever the pleasure of going and working in Buenos Aires, I've been there and worked in the beautiful Teatro Colón, and the concert was memorable, but so was the tango that we heard after the concert. You know, the authentic tango tradition there, and hearing these musicians who were not maybe classically educated, totally absorbed in that particular sound world, was absolutely revelatory. And it's always a challenge when we, as our sort of chameleon selves, classical musicians, just tread on their territory a little bit and try and find the freedom and the sense of rhythmic swing that is so sort of ingrained in that musical style. But I'm intrigued to see what these pieces sound like in this arrangement for bassoon solo. It's easy listening music, and it really fits very well into this program because it allows us just to get lost momentarily in music, which is entirely less complex and more directly speaking to our sort of rhythmic inner selves.
Right. Less complex, but still, it's kind of like playing Strauss waltzes.
Yeah.
You know, if you're not Austrian,
yeah,
you're not going to exactly get it 100%.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there may be truth in that. I mean, we'll keep trying, though.
But, you know, I mean, that is. It's like there are musicians that spend their lifetime just, you know, mastering that music that sort of bridges art music and folk music in a way.
Yeah. It's a very interesting issue that you raise because, I mean, when you think about Viennese style, even when you think you're being as specific as to isolate a style from a small region, you can find tremendous diversity in performing traditions. I'm thinking immediately when you said Viennese style, there are three major orchestras in Vienna. And if you put the same program of Viennese music in front of each of those orchestras, it would sound different. So what is the Viennese style? There are several character traits. I mean, one of the things that Piazzolla loves is the offbeat rhythms, always placing these little playful accents against our sense of pulse and just shaking the rhythm a little bit so that it becomes free of its sort of shackles and bounds that we sort of live in. So often as classical musicians, we have four beats in a bar, and the accents come on the first and the third, and the second and the fourth are slightly lighter. You know, all of that goes out the window here. He tries to create rhythms that animate in different ways. And I think in the 21st century, we've become more accustomed as classical musicians to approaching rhythms of that complexity and of that sort of nature. So I think we stand a better chance these days than we did maybe sort of 30, 40 years ago, where our attentions were spent on legato lines and singing phrases and long bows. But it's still a challenge. You're absolutely right. And I think, you know, I don't know whether there's anybody on the stage who was born and bred in Argentina. I haven't asked yet. But we will try our best to try and conjure up the atmosphere of those heady clubs in Buenos Aires.
And it's fun music to play.
It really is fun.
Yeah. And hearing this with a bassoon, I know we're speaking Thursday, you've yet to rehearse it, but it's going to be really interesting because we're so used to hearing the bandoneon playing the lead line in all of his music and in just about all Nuevo Tango.
Exactly. And also piano transcriptions of these works as well. I mean, and string quintet versions. And because it's essentially quite a simple language, I mean, certainly not simple rhythmically, but harmonically, despite the fact that these are quite sort of developed chords, very rich chords that he's exploring, it comes from a fairly safe place harmonically. And technically, for the musician, the demands are really entirely rhythmic. There's not too much else to worry about. So you can sort of sit back in your seat a bit and swagger. With a lot of his music, and I think that's why we enjoy playing it so much.
Well, let's hear a little bit of the Milonga, which is the middle movement you'll be performing, and this is in the traditional version with a bandoneon and a string quartet, in this case, a small chamber ensemble. Here's music by Astor Piazzolla. ¶¶ It's music by Piazzolla, which will be performed in the Tulsa Symphony's final classics concert of the season, featuring Astor Piazzolla's Angel Series, featuring principal bassoonist Richard Ramey, and Richard Strauss's Till Eulenspiegel's Merry Pranks, and Rachmaninoff's Symphonic Dances. So it sounds like it's going to be a great program. And this has been a really exciting year for you. I know you've had a number of debuts with orchestras. What's been most exciting for you so far this year?
Interesting question. I'm very lucky. I have a job which takes me to very interesting countries very often, and I get to spend my time in the office, in inverted commas, amongst extremely talented musicians. I've had a couple of very lovely debuts this year. Working with Chicago was, of course, a great highlight. It's one of the world's truly great orchestras.
And singing with the chorus, singing
absolutely.
Too.
Absolutely. The chorus is one of the few sort of professional choruses that works alongside one of these top-tier symphony orchestras. So that was a great privilege and a marvelous hall. But I enjoy, it doesn't really matter where I am. I just love music, and I really, it sounds like a cliche. The challenge is always the travel. I try and sort of blot that out as much as possible, but I feel always energized when I arrive in a new city, and make music with fabulous like-minded musicians. I can't complain about that.
All right. Well, Matthew, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Tulsa Symphony Orchestra guest conductor Matthew Hall speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He'll be leading the orchestra in their final classics concert of the season tomorrow evening at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center's Chapman Music Hall, featuring the music of Rachmaninoff, Richard Strauss, and Astor Piazzolla's Angel Series, featuring principal bassoonist Richard Ramey. For details on the concert, visit tulsasymphony.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. We're going to leave you with more music from the concert tomorrow evening. This is the music of Rachmaninoff from his Symphonic Dances. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.